This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we get in-depth reports from the Gulf Coast, where BP's massive oil gusher continues to threaten the ocean and the Louisiana coastline. We'll speak to marine toxicologist Ricky Ott and our special correspondent Larry Everest. And I say my goodbyes to the Flashpoint show. All this and more straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. BP's latest last-ditch effort has in some way inhibited the flow of oil, but it has not come close to fully sealing the leak and solving the massive oil gusher. The current situation is tenuous at best. It appears that a delicate top-kill operation is undermining the current attempt to seal the gusher. Joining us to talk about the continuing impact on the Gulf of Mexico and the potential dangers, and she knows a lot about that, is Ricky Ott. Ott is a marine toxicologist and former commercial salmon fisher person in Alaska. She is also the author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Spill. Ricky Ott, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Last we spoke with you, it was when we had a little spill, and I guess it's little in comparison to what's going on now, but here in the Bay Area. So welcome back. And I just want to get your take as of this moment. They had one more last-ditch effort. It appears that they have in some way inhibited the flow, but what's your take at this moment, at this hour?
Well, why is all this experimental? I mean, what we're dealing with is 31-year-old technology, booms, dispersants, burning. We're not certainly not dealing with 31-year-old technology when it comes to getting the oil out of the ground. So I am actually betting on the relief wells at this point. If we had something better, we would have tried to use it, I think, in the Timor Sea spill in Australia. So I say just keep, I think this is the only time I'll say it, you know, just keep drilling those relief wells. And that, you know, that'll be the final part there. But much more concern from my perspective is the workers that were put in harm's way out working on the spill response.
Well, I want to ask you about that in one moment. But, you know, it came up at the president's press conference today in which it appeared that there was some kind of limiting, I wouldn't call it a moratorium on drilling, but the comparison of Katrina, but really the real comparison here that helps people a little bit more is Exxon Valdez and how that can compare and how that is, say, still affecting the Alaskan coastline. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, and because affecting the coastline, I mean, we're all connected, the people who fish and use the coastline, the communities on the coastline, and we've got parallels there between Alaska and what's going on in the Gulf. So Exxon Valdez, unfortunately, the killing did not stop in 1989. It pretty much took out the young of the year that were in the water column or on the beaches, case of herring and pink salmon, which spawn on the beaches, so that there was a delayed ecosystem collapse 4 years later when the young of the year should have grown up and become adults and appeared in the ecosystem, and they just didn't. And, like, that's a grave concern with the Gulf because there's also a lot of young in the year right now in the Gulf, and not only in the open ocean, but also in the marshes and coastal estuaries. And the oil, of course, is rolling in now, both on the surface and subsurface. So there's a concern that we could be looking at a delayed ecosystem collapse in the Gulf as well. I mean, it might not be all clear once the leak gets stopped and once, the oil's done washing ashore. We could be looking at future impacts down the road to the ecosystem.
The estimates now are, take your pick from 60,000 barrels, or let's just talk in gallons. They're saying it could be upwards over 1 million gallons a day. What can we expect to see from that kind of leak?
First of all, I think it probably always has been that. I don't think it's like getting faster over time. I think it was just underestimated and underreported at the beginning. Well, what we can see, There's a couple things. One is that the oil that's leaking has a lot more light ends. It's a higher proportion of chemicals or hydrocarbons, like at the gas station, when you go to the gas station. In California in particular, there's a vapor recovery system because these volatile organic carbons are toxic to people. They're hazardous. Oil spill cleanup is a hazardous waste cleanup declared in regulations. And this oil, these volatile organic carbons, they also dissolve into the water column. And they're very toxic to young life forms. So again, I think we're going to have serious impacts on all the young of the year in the water column this year. And we're going to see holes in the ecosystem, I'm thinking. Now, how robust the system is, how well it can, how many other threads there are in the ecosystem, in the food web, I think time will tell. But meanwhile, we're also dealing with communities of people who, this is their culture. This is a life, a choice to live and fish. And people have done it for, I've talked to people four generations, and I know they even go back further than that. One lady in Venice said, you know, I don't want BP's money. I want my community. And that community is a fishing community, and it lives in the bayous and the marshes. And that, there's a disconnect there. We saw that in Exxon Valdez, too, where Exxon tried to throw money at the people. And, like, that was all that we wanted, and that's not what we wanted. We have herring fishermen in Prince William Sound who are still not fishing herring from something that happened 21 years ago. And that could put a serious ding on people's culture here. These people are tough. They've survived multiple hurricanes. Clint Guidry today just said, you know, we've been through four major hurricanes in 5 years. And that's cost us. We've had to rebuild time and again. We can't really afford any more small business loans, which is one of the solutions that's being tossed out right now. Oh, just give payment deferral. Well, all that will do is there'll be interest heaped on the debt. And that's what got us in Cordova in the end was mounding interest to the point where people actually had to give their entire punitive damage award away when they finally got it 21 years later. I know people who have declared bankruptcy. When Exxon finally paid us in December of last year, people are going bankrupt now from something that happened, you know, over 21 years
ago. If they're still alive.
Right. And that's another thing. About a third after this incredible... and we've heard BP say the same thing, by the way, in Congress. We will pay all legitimate claims. What that means, that's code for we will, you know, so go ahead and sue us, and we'll decide what's legitimate in court. And we will fight with all of our manpower and legal power. And, you know, we're talking billions and billions of dollars at their disposal. So this was not a very encouraging sign to hear BP say we will pay all legitimate claims. And the level of stress that generates in a town, actually, it's way different than what people have faced with these hurricanes. I mean, they come back, their home is devastated, flattened, gone, and they say it's just a little bit of hard work, you know, to get back to rebuild. And unfortunately, when you have this much financial stress and you're in these lawsuits for decades, literally, it's very wearing, and it makes people act in ways that they normally wouldn't. So in Cordova, we became a case study on disaster trauma, and there were spikes, horrible spikes in substance abuse and domestic violence and divorces and suicides, and that actually stayed high for the 20 years that we were in litigation. So there's multiple ways these small communities could be impacted, you know, by having the fishing cut from them for years, by having the marshes oiled, and by having this heap of financial stress. And small business loans, we've got to get more creative than that, because all that's going to do is accumulate debt. And that's what ate a lot of people in Cordova in the end.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are speaking with Ricky Ott. Ott is a marine toxicologist and a former commercial salmon fisher woman in Alaska. She is also the author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Spill. Let's talk a little bit about the spill and the cleanup. At this hour, one of the head leaders of BP, Doug Scuttle, says that on CNN that they have restarted pumping mud back into the well, I guess within an hour or so ago. They had suspended this because they were having trouble with their top kill operation. Talk a little bit about the top kill operation and how dangerous this is for the people who are working on the cleanup now.
So as of last night, and I've actually been off email all day, so I haven't got the latest, but there were 9 people who were basically medevaced from working on the spill response work in situ, so out on the ocean, to a local hospital in Barataria, Louisiana. And BP also pulled off 125 boats because of concern for hazardous work conditions. These hazardous work conditions didn't just like originate overnight. This is what I've been hearing for the 3 weeks that I've been down there, is constant complaints from people about these cold and flu-like symptoms and headaches and dizziness. And this is, you know, dead ringer for Exxon Valdez. Exxon called it the Valdez crud and was able to use a loophole in the OSHA reporting requirements for hazardous waste cleanups that if it's a cold or a flu, you don't have to report it. The problem is that the symptoms for chemical-induced illnesses, and this can be straight up from crude oil by itself, the volatile organic carbon, the symptoms mimic colds and flu. So you could have chemical-induced illnesses masquerading as a cold and flu. And you don't really find out the difference unless you do long-term monitoring, because people get over a cold. But to get over chemical poisoning, they actually have to do a chemical detox program, which a number of workers did with Exxon Valdez down in Texas at the Environmental Health Clinic Dallas with Dr. William Ray. If you don't get treated, and if you under the pretense that you have a cold or a flu, what happens is that these hydrocarbons park in your body, and there can be a lot more serious chronic illnesses that manifest over time. And to this day, I am still dealing with sick cleanup workers who are 100% disabled. Unfortunately, some have, a lot of them actually have died. From being misdiagnosed and not given proper long-term health care from the responsible party back in 1989, Exxon. And I'm one of the reasons I'm throwing myself at this oil spill down there and helping work in these communities, because I sure don't want to see a repeat of what happened with the sick worker saga with the BP Gulf spill.
Now, first of all, let's talk about the inadvertent, not just the workers, but kids and teenagers and, getting out for the summer and active in the spring and the beautiful weather. How could this impact on teenagers, kids who dig around in this stuff and pregnant moms?
Well, this is a huge problem, and unfortunately, I hear the Obama administration still kind of downplaying it, and they understand why. We saw the same thing happen in Alaska. Oh, the beaches are beautiful. We need tourism. Just because we've had this little oil spill, don't mind that. Come to see our beautiful beaches. What I'd like to see, really here, we've got a problem. We've got this underwater plume of toxic gunk, courtesy of BP, with dumping unprecedented amounts, really, of dispersant over unprecedented time, sustained over time. Never have we done this. Hundreds of thousands of gallons of toxic solvents into the water column. And we all saw the footage of Philippe Cousteau. If you haven't, you need to. It's like this stuff that's gooey, gunky stuff that's in a plume, and it can wash ashore anywhere. And if it washes ashore, then it's going to get churned by the waves, turned by wind, and the locals are saying, hey, you know, the hurricane season starts in June. If this toxic stew gets into the air, people can aspirate it, people can inhale it, and this could be really a problem. We need EPA down there doing continuous monitoring of the beaches, of the air quality, of the water quality. We need these coastal communities to adopt some sort of flag system, like they have a flag system warning swimmers when it's safe, when conditions are safe, when they're not safe. We could adopt that for chemical poisoning as well. You know, low problem in the wind today. You know, the wind's okay, air quality's okay. I mean, I know there's this tension between wanting tourists to come and, yeah, people that stand to lose billions of dollars between Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana just now. You know, maybe Florida if it gets there. But the thing is, do you really want to jeopardize workers? I mean, public health. And when the cleanup workers have been coming home, well, cleanup, response workers have been coming home, they've been seeing some of their family members, you know, mirror their same symptoms. So I know that off and on we've had, I had a wicked sore throat when I was down in Venice for the last 3 days, and the snuffly nose deal. And it was, you know, not a good thing. Cleared up when I left. I think we need to take this a little bit more seriously and at least have EPA out there monitoring air quality, water quality, and have it be at BP's expense. They spilled it.
Now, I know that you were down there, and I understand you spent some time with somebody who we've had on the air quite a bit. That would be Kendra Arneson, who's living in Venice at the Gulf. She has a boat, and about 2 days ago, she went out on the water with her husband, and they went out sort of into the ocean, into the Gulf, and they came upon situations where there were hundreds and hundreds of birds diving into what appeared to be sort of boiling water, but it was the fish they call big reds, sort of with their mouths out of the water, apparently gasping for whatever. Can you help us understand what was happening there?
Well, I it's a guess, but it's based on what the universities that came back and reported their findings in the New York Times, where they said there's actually low dissolved oxygen associated with the use of dispersants and with these big plumes. And, I mean, I don't know if it's related to that or what. It's pretty unusual to have somebody who's experienced on these waters say, I have never seen this before. So I think this is something we need to be paying attention to. And I'm hoping that there's some university folks that, and the EPA, you know, that we should have, and NOAA. I mean, for gosh sakes, after Exxon Valdez, we had NOAA out there doing ecosystem studies that lasted nearly a decade, but from start to finish when they were actually published. And instead, what we have is Senator Markey, a congressman, you know, writing a letter to BP saying, would you please pay would you please do ecological monitoring? We, the federal government, should just be saying NOAA is going to be cut loose to do proper ecological monitoring for multiple generations of sea life, and we are going to be submitting the bill to BP. I mean, end of story. Why are we asking BP to study? We don't want BP studying this. We want independent studies.
We heard the president, honestly, forgive me, but regurgitating a lot of the statistics about everything that BP was doing to prevent the oil that started pouring out quite a few days ago from coming into shore. And yet that contradicted one report after another of our people on the front line, talking to a park manager at Grand Island, going out on the boat with Kendra, that there were huge sections where there was no boom. And Obama is saying it's just a matter of how we're going to use the boom. It's not, you know, it's you can't expect to get it all. Your response?
Yeah, well, I hope President Obama does another talk after he goes and sees what's really going on there for himself. his channels of information are political filters and political lenses. What you're seeing when you actually go out with people like Kendra and other Louisiana shrimpers and oystermen, you know, is the kind of the front line truth. And they don't jibe, and they're not going to jibe ever. And I'm hoping President Obama can actually talk to some of the people that I've met with. The first African-American fisherman, the Vietnamese-American fisherman, the Native American fishermen. I mean, people who, the Creoles, the people like Kendra who have been there multiple generations. I mean, this is their home, and they're seeing it with love in their hearts and, you know, very sadness as well, and saying this is, we have not seen anything like this before. And at some point, I hope what the front line, the real front line is seeing doesn't get covered up by the political reality that, you know, this is going to force Americans to decide, do we want to keep relying on oil? It is toxic to people. It's making workers sick. It's potentially making health effects. And it's definitely going to sicken the environment. It did in Prince William Sound. Of course it's going to do it down here. And it's frying the planet. I mean, I think this is, we're at a crossroads, and I think we the people have to be making some decisions now. What is our future course? Obama has given us a little leeway with saying, and I thank him for that, pulling back and saying, stop, on Outer Continental Shelf, we're just going to reevaluate this whole mess we've got ourselves into. When President Obama, when I heard him say, we're doing everything we can, yes, that's true. But what's also true is that the cleanup technology is 31 years old. Ixtox, we saw boom, dispersant. They called it a sombrero back then, this top kill procedure. I mean, come on. It didn't work 31 years ago. Why are we still using this stuff? The industry has not done the research and the hard work to come up with a state-of-the-art cleanup and containment activity. I mean, we're not using 31-year-old oil drilling technology.
Well, it was very interesting when he said, well, the industry's technology is ahead of our own. He says, so when we need to depend on the oil company's expertise, that's what he admitted.
And a lot of people don't understand that. We have taken a different course than, say, Norway. I've been over to Norway. The Norwegian government treats oil spills like war. And they have boom and material. In fact, they actually, for a number of years, banned chemical dispersants because they out of concern for their fish. And, you know, they do a lot of fish farming over there. I'm not condoning fish farming. We certainly don't want it in Alaska. But the fact of the matter was the Norwegian government made a call that, hey, we have other industries that are valuable here, and we don't want oil dispersed down into the water column like what we see going on in the Gulf. And Norway, the Norwegian government has the spill response equipment and has the mechanical equipment and has the manpower to basically federalize these oil spills. We do not. We made the call that we're going to believe the industry, and if they can, you know, do all this drilling, surely they'll have the cleanup technology. We have EPA that maintains a product schedule as part of the National Oil and Hazardous Substance Pollution Contingency Plan. But EPA, all it does is it basically rubber stamps whatever industry wants. And this has been a huge problem in terms of handicapping and hindering development of technology that actually might work to contain and get the oil out of the water. After Exxon Valdez, after this BP blowout, Cordova got inundated with people saying, I have a way that we can help. We can help clean it up. Well, where is EPA with all of, you know, these other technologies? EPA just basically rubber stamps the industry. That's a problem. If we're going to rely on the industry like we do to clean up their messes, then at least what we ought to do is do what we do in Alaska now, post Exxon Valdez, which is that we have citizen councils that say to the industry, all right, this is your contingency plan. EPA signed off on all this. Okay, now prove that it works. And lo and behold, a lot of the things that are on paper don't actually work on practice, like what we're seeing in the Gulf. So in Alaska, the citizens have actually forced, the citizen advisory councils have forced the industry to improve and actually take steps that will actually, well, actually, we're stronger on prevention now than cleanup. Cleanup, we're still lagging behind. We still have dispersants on the books that the industry could not demonstrate actually work to meet EPA's 45% minimum effectiveness standards in cold water with Alaska North Slope crude. So I'm really glad Obama has shut down Shell oil in the Arctic Ocean at this point. And that will be for this year at least.
You know, you could say, Ricky Ott, that it takes a spill to kill a village. Now, I know that you saw this in Alaska, and the way in which, you know, it destroys the local industry, it destroys the people who spend their life on the water, it sickens their children, and then it really destroys families, and there's more fighting. And could you talk about what this does to the every level of quality of life?
Well, it basically gutted our community, and we spent 4 years waiting for Exxon to take care of us, the state to help us, the federal government. I mean, Exxon said, we will make you whole. We believed them. And it actually took the Fish Run collapse in 1993, so 4 years after the Exxon Valdez, when our herring and our pink salmon collapsed, to realize that, you know what, nobody was going to take care of us. We had better figure out what were the problems and how were we as a community going to come together and address them. And that is another thing I'm down in the Gulf trying to encourage people to do, is don't believe BP that they're going to take care of you. Don't believe the state. Don't believe the federal government. Knit together your communities all across the Gulf that have dealt with hurricane after hurricane after hurricane. You already know a great deal of social trauma. Activate those networks now. Don't wait for the collapse to come. Don't wait for the financial hardships to come. Just plan on all that stuff happening. So what kind of steps can you take now to safeguard and protect some of your communities? And one of the things I'm sharing with them is count your family as important as going to these BP trainings, these supposed worker safety trainings that are only 4 hours instead of 40 hours. But schedule time with your family, just like a meeting time. And in that hour or 2 hours that you spend with your family, don't talk about the oil spill. Don't talk about anything like that. Talk about what's important to your children. Talk about what's important to each other. Just take, you know, decompress. You need time to decompress, or you're gonna have the same thing that happened to us, which is when we blew our families apart. So that's the kind of message I'm sharing. Is like, and people are hearing it, which is really cool. And they're also hearing the message about, okay, you know, we had sick workers at Exxon Valdez. You've got workers out there without respirators. You've got workers without respirators. Your illnesses are the same illnesses that we had. What do you think? And fishermen said, well, we want respirators. And so fishermen 2 weeks ago a week ago on Sunday, asked President Obama for an executive order to ban toxic chemicals being used further applied in the Gulf. I mean, that's the kind of thing that the power of the people. And from that, we had EPA saying, hey, you know, push back. BP, give us some non-toxic alternatives, and, you know, then BP pushed back. But the point of the matter is the people are finding their voice, finding their power, and starting to make demands. And I think that's healthy.
All right, Ricky, one final fact I've been looking for. Do you know how many holes there are under the ocean now? How many wounds in Mother Earth offshore are there?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually have no idea, but I have
a lot,
A lot, thousands. I have seen footage of, well, especially after Katrina, of all the underwater pipes for the oil industry in the Gulf Coast area, and it looks like a pot of spaghetti that's just been dumped on the floor. It's amazing, and I'd really like to see us Americans seize this opportunity to seriously come to grips with our energy future and ask ourselves some hard questions. You know, I talk to fifth graders through university students, and they are facing a big adult problem, climate crisis, that's being dumped on some very young laps. And, you know, they need some leadership in adults right now to help resolve what is our energy future going to look like. We can't leave it up to these oil companies on these coal and gas. We the people have to step up.
All right. Ricky Ott, we want to thank you for your time. Let people know that you're a marine toxicologist, former commercial salmon fisherwoman in Alaska. You are the author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Spill. A great deal of information. It is always wonderful to have you with us and very informative. Please be careful, and we'd love to be able to check back with you.
Sounds good. I'm heading back down to the Gulf in another week.
We'll talk to you. We'll talk to you when you're down there. Thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. BP's corporate wound in the bottom of the ocean continued to spew millions of gallons of oil a day. Meanwhile, the corporate giant says they've got a plan. At this hour, they're attempting to plug the massive hole in the earth with heavy mud and cement. Noted scientist Ted Pazek at the University of Texas said that if it doesn't work, he doesn't even want to think about the consequences. He stated, and I quote, that this would create an environmental disaster of a caliber that was heretofore unseen by humanity. Meanwhile, residents along the Gulf Coast are getting more and more angry by the day as BP officials continue to lie, stonewall, and keep them in the dark while keeping them at a distance from the ocean that they would love to help save. Joining us to talk about this is Larry Everest, and we'll be back with Kendra Arneson in one moment. Larry, welcome back.
Hey, Dennis.
Well, we're going to talk more about that meeting you went to yesterday as we were speaking to you. But give us an overview of what happened.
Well, at the meeting?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it was just an exercise in lying, in damage control, in trying to put people off and paralyze them. There was a representative, Larry Thompson, the PR director from BP, happened to be a black man that they sent out to do this. A Captain Stanton, who is the head of the Coast Guard, and a Mr. Carroll from the EPA. And it was just one stonewall after another. And it really, and here are some of the outrageous things that were said. Stanton of the Coast Guard claimed this was not an environmental disaster. It was an economic disaster because people had been put out of work. Certainly it was an economic disaster. But to say this is not an environmental disaster goes along with what the U.S. government, what BP, and what the entire capitalist system has been doing from the beginning, which is greatly downplaying and trying to hide the magnitude of this catastrophe, as you were mentioning in your run-up to this. One of the people in the room called him out on this, and this Coast Guard guy was supposed to backtrack and hem and haw. He claimed that, well, I was just talking about the marshes. It's not an environmental disaster there. Of course, if we talk about the deep ocean, it maybe it's different, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, and fishermen will tell you, the deep ocean and the marshlands are interconnected. You can't separate them. And second, even some of the officials were out at Passalutra today saying they were seeing oil 3 feet high onto these reeds, that the whole area was already dying. The other totally outrageous thing, and I'm sure Kendra will talk more about this, was the person from the EPA would not even make a clear statement until pinned down and about what the EPA approved as a dispersant. And, you know, they sure, we're for this. We're for this dispersant, despite the fact that the EPA, head of the EPA admitted it was toxic and BP should try to use something else. BP refused. The EPA caved. But that's all I'll say on that. The other thing was, it was very interesting because the you know, the mode of operation. And look, this is a very deliberate, and I know you've analyzed this on the show, Dennis. This is a deliberate effort by these agencies. And the other interesting thing was the Coast Guard and the EPA were like running interference for BP in this whole thing. They were out in out more in front, having to try to say more than even BP did. And they were all on the same page. They were all singing the same tune. And it just, again, goes to show that drilling for oil, having control of global oil, and continuing to fuel capitalism on oil is something they have a common interest in and a shared agenda. But you know, the thing that really struck me, and I thought about this after the meeting, Dennis, is these are a real effort to try to paralyze people. People were mad. People were frustrated. People got up and asked some very sharp questions, made some very good statements. But this is an effort to just play people along, to keep them paralyzed until it is too late to save the marsh. This has been going on 36, 37 days now. They knew that the oil was going to pour into these marshes. They knew that from the beginning. And I want to talk about the size of the spill in just a moment. And they've been seeking to pacify and people and feed into people's disbelief and fear about believing the worst could happen. They have not mounted the effort to stop this that they could have. And I'm beginning to feel that I want to look into this more, but I'm beginning to feel we have a couple of weeks of a window before the Mississippi River goes down, before this huge volume of water, which has been keeping the oil offshore, dwindles, and this pool of oil comes in and invades the marshes and kills this whole area. And people at the meeting spoke very powerfully. So I just think the need for resistance is so urgent right now. And I just heard on the news that even some of the officials at Plaquemines Parish are talking about having people down there just begin on Saturday if not enough is being done. And I think I would add I hope this becomes a much broader effort by people all over the country, because this is part of the global disaster. This isn't just a local issue. This is for all of us to be concerned. The other thing I just want to mention briefly, Dennis, I'm sure many of the listeners watch CNN. They've had near continuous coverage of the oil escaping from this blowout preventer. And the first thing that struck me is we're getting 8 different video cameras, crystal clear pictures of this, including something I hadn't seen, which is 3 different shoots, jets of oil and methane and natural gas coming out of this blowout preventer. Crystal clear pictures. Where has this been all along? Why haven't we seen it? Why haven't the scientists been able to evaluate this? And this is a key issue. They're hiding the size to this day, the size of this disaster. Scientists are saying it's not the 5,000 barrels a day BP's talking about. It's between 75 and 115,000 barrels. That's 100 million to 150 million gallons every single day.
No, that's... that's not a no. That's a million. That's not
75,000 barrels, according to the newspaper down here. 75,000 barrels.
42 gallons in a barrel, or 45?
Yeah, 42.
Somebody do the math. It's a lot. I'm not sure, because I think the entire they're estimating that the actual reservoir is something like.
That's correct. I'm speaking of the 97 to 149 million gallons. What I'm speaking about is the 31-day range of this. That's what I'm speaking about. It's a 75 to 115,000 barrels a day, and it's a total of 97 to 150 million gallons over 31 days, which would make it 10 to 15 times times larger than the Exxon Valdez.
Okay, and now, this is something. Go on. Let me just say, I've been looking at these leaks now, and I've been watching this, and it is frightening. And these massive leaks coming out of these three, or at least three wounds, or partial wounds in the earth. And there's a reason. You ask about what's going on here. Why do they want to limit people's knowledge, even though they write on the second page of their own 600-page response plan that you need to assess get a good assessment of how big the leak is, because that's the best way to understand how to deal with it. But they don't want to, because then that's where the lawsuits come in. So they're really apparently focusing on how to limit their damage, how to control their damage and the lawsuits, rather than allow people to take a real shot at trying to restrain the damage. How bad is it now? Before you left, I know you're in New Orleans now. How bad was it when you left? What did you hear from people about what they were seeing, and what did you see in terms of how bad it is right now in Louisiana along the coast and in the marshes?
Well, I was at Paso Lutra, and I saw the marshes, the beginning of the killing, or what looked to be the beginning of the killing of the marshes. I got this oil, I saw this oil beginning to pool up in the water, and felt how sticky and how horrible it would be if any animals came through. I was on Grand Isle and saw where it had washed up on the beaches. And by the way, no one in sight cleaning any of this up with these pools of oil. And I saw where it was actually beginning to come through the gap between Elmer Island and Grand Isle, and potentially getting into the marshes. I saw photos of big pools of oil near Elmer Isle. But this is just what I'm concerned about. Is this is just the beginning? And the point you're making is so important about them covering up the damage. Even to this day, the news media and the U.S. government and BP are not making a controversy and a story out of this issue of the number of barrels a day that are blowing out of this. There's BP's liability, and it just shows how deeply rooted this issue of profitability is in this whole situation. This is what created this, the drive for profit and control of this oil, and this is how it's being played now, where profit, where strategic advantage, where control of oil is being placed by this system at all levels ahead of the marsh and the fate of the planet and the environment of the planet.
All right. Now, Larry, people can follow your work at revolutionbooks.org. There's a click on there at revolutionbooks.org for your blog. You're going to be blogging. I know you're giving a lecture in New Orleans tonight, but we're going to stay with you, Larry. We appreciate the information. And thanks for joining us. Be careful.
Well, and Dennis, people down and I know Kendra will say the same thing, down here are very appreciative of people in other parts of the country staying on this story, telling the truth, letting the world know what's going on. So I'm, very glad you're on this thing.
Okay, what we're going to do, thank you very much, Larry Everest, reporting
easy,
from the region in New Orleans now, just back from the Gulf. We're going to get rid of that signal, and we're going to listen to a little bit of the music that we have queued up, and then we're going to come back, and hopefully we'll have Kendra. Stay with us.
Whose garden was this? It must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one. Whose river was this? You say it ran freely. Blue was its color. I've seen blue in some pictures, and you tell me you've been there. Tell me again, I need to know. The forests had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose gray sky was this? Or was it a blue one? Nights here were breezes. I've heard records of breezes. And you tell me you felt one. Tell me again, I need to know. The forest had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose garden was this? Must have been lovely. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one.
Tom Paxton, Whose Garden Was This? And we are definitely worried about the garden. In one moment, we'll be speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. Want to let you know I have, speaking of the environment, war destroys the environment. And I have the honor of hosting a KPFA benefit for the interns to go and do some great work. And this benefit is for the First Voice Media Collective. First Voice is sending local grassroots media producers from the Bay Area to Detroit to attend the Allied Media Conference and the U.S. Social Forum. We're anxious to support that. We're also anxious to hear Pratap Chatterjee and Karen Chowdhury talk about the what we now call the AFPAC war, the expanding war, Obama's expanding war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. With two people who know a great deal about it, Pratap Chatterjee, one of the most astute and most effective investigative reporters working today, has done a lot of work on what the contractors are doing and how they're making multi-billion dollar deals on the backs of the young and on endless war. And Karen Chowdhury is a marvelous professor at UC Berkeley who will talk about, sort of give us an overview in the history and what the dangers are on a grand scale. Delighted to be there. For those of you in the Bay Area, it's Thursday, June 10th at UC Berkeley, 145 Dwinnell Hall. That's Thursday, June 10th, 7 p.m. I look forward to seeing you there and learning a great deal that night. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're now joined by Catherine Austin Fitz. We could not track down Kendra Arneson, so she's got a lot on her mind. There's a lot that she's doing, so we're going to stay with her and see what happens over the next couple of days. Catherine, welcome back.
Hi, Dennis.
Well, you're not that far from the Gulf, and
this
must be the talk of the town, huh?
Yeah, the Gulf is very much on our mind because, you know, Memphis, I live outside of Memphis, and of course, the New Orleans is and the Mississippi River is the port through which everything goes through, and the life of the commodities here is very much tied up with the economy and transportation and all sorts of things going on in the Gulf. So there's and they're very strong family and personal and business networks back and forth, and I think the spill will be devastating for not just the economy of the Gulf, but for the whole Southeast and then for the whole country. And very little, you know, most Americans don't seem to understand what's going to happen economically and the ripple effect back and how it's going to affect them, but it's definitely coming. Now, also, you know, if you look at the different predictions of environmental potential environmental damage, and I'm not competent to know which are true and which are not. It's not just the economic damage that could ripple back. The oil and the chemicals used to clean it up could get into the environment a variety of ways and ripple back and affect, you know, a great deal of North America. So this is very significant.
Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows, and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world will our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed have we come to believe?
In the studio with me is Nora Barris Friedman. Nora, how did we meet?
We met, I believe it was January or February of 2003, when I couldn't stand that my country was bombing people in Afghanistan, and I was at home with a very small child at the time. Luckily, I was able to take a couple years off to be a mom for the first few years of her life, but I couldn't sit still and watch this all happen. And so I decided to I had been listening to Flashpoints and Democracy Now! Nonstop, you know, ever since, I don't know, 1998, something like that. And so I came in here to volunteer in the phone room, actually. And I saw my old friend Dev Ross, who's one of our engineers here. And he was my teacher at Youth Radio when I was a student there in 1994 and 5. And I saw Anita Johnson, who works at a Hard Knock Radio. And
another classmate.
Another classmate, yeah. Of mine at Youth Radio. And I think I was in the phone room and I saw you come in and I recognized you from your voice. And I said, hey, I'm Nora. I think you know my mom. She's a poet. I think I had even sent you a poem of hers to read on the air at some point earlier.
And you were urging me to put her on the air.
Yeah. And so what you did was you said, don't stay in the phone room. Come inside and help me pitch. And so literally 5 minutes after meeting you, you had brought me into the phone room and you said, here, I know you like poetry. You gave me a book of Muriel Rukeyser's poems that you had on the desk here where we are sitting now. And you said, just pick one that, you know, kind of resonates with what we're talking about today. And I was like, this is the most bizarre thing that's ever happened to me. And so I did. And you were, you know, going on and on about calling in and pitching and supporting this scrappy radio show called Flashpoints. And then at the end of the show, you offered me an internship. And I started the next month. And the day that I started the internship was the day of the Shock and Awe campaign. And 2 days after Rachel Corrie was murdered by Israeli modified American bulldozers. So,
and that was a little more than 7 years ago?
That was almost 7.5 years ago.
Wow. And it was very powerful because we had spoken with Rachel and wanted to put her on, but we decided we were going to do it next week, but she didn't live till next week. But you, Nora, have managed to survive. And I want to say the network got their money's worth. I'm not saying that people shouldn't take their holidays and shouldn't take their vacations, you know, and stuff like that. But you were very, very generous and used to take your vacation to go to Palestine and report for us every day and help to train youth there to be able to report to us. And there was at least one time when it came close to costing your life or major damage to your your body when one of these big, concussion? I don't know what it was.
It was a rubber, plastic-coated steel bullet.
And that shattered the glass to your right, your left, your head.
Yeah.
And you have always put in that kind of effort. And that's because, and not to mention learning Arabic to cover the most important story in the world. But you've always gone that extra mile.
Thank you.
And it was always appreciated. And because, as I was saying, you believe in this work, this is not a 9-to-5. And I know your phone, like mine, rings 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's people who are in the middle of life and death situations where you can't say, hold on, I gotta go get the takeout pizza.
Right.
And you're going to keep doing this work.
And I'm going to keep doing this. So this is kind of my farewell from Flashpoints on the daily. But I will, of course, keep contributing. And when I go back to Palestine in the fall, I'll keep reporting. And I'll still be around. You can't get rid of me that easily.
Right. And we're going to figure out ways to keep you with us.
Yeah. And Dennis, I just want to say also that you have been the most amazing mentor for me. I mean, you've taught me everything I know about journalism, about writing, about storytelling, about listening, and not just things that have to do with the work that we do here on Flashpoints, but in my parenting and in my relationships with other people and in the way that I perceive the world. I mean, you've really been the best teacher to me, and I'm going to start to cry now.
Me too.
You've been the best teacher to me that I ever could have asked for. And so, you know, it's been an honor to be here at Flashpoints for the last 7.5 years, and it will continue to be an honor to be in the lives of those who are around us in the production staff and in listener land. I'm gonna miss doing the day to day, but I'm also
there's plenty of other projects. I'm not going to give them away now, but we have definitely not seen the last of Nora Barros Friedman, and there's going to be a huge hole in this show and this network represented by your absence. And so I thank you for those beautiful, kind words. And, you know, I don't have any children, but sometimes it felt like I did.
Yeah.
And especially when you were out there risking your life, and I'm just thinking to myself, you know, about you and about your beautiful daughter, Ciel, who has, you know,
she's been very generous with her time as well.
Yeah, and, you know, so.
Thanks.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barros Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.